with another man, who was strapping on a dueling glove. It slowly dawned on the thief that a duel was but moments away. Squeezing between the two guards, Crocus craned his neck to find the other duelist. At first, he thought in the giant with the dragon mask and two-handed sword. Then his gaze found the man. Ralik Nom. His eyes snapped back to the first duelist. Familiar. He nudged the guard on his left.
Is that Councilman Turbinor?
It is, sir.
The guard replied, an odd tightness in his tone. Crocus glanced up to see the man's face wet with sweat, trickling down from under his peaked helmet.
Strange. So, where's Lady Simtal?
He asked casually.
Nowhere in sight,
the guard answered, with obvious relief.
Otherwise, she'd stop this.
Crocus nodded at that.
Well, he said, Ralik will win.
The guard's gaze was on him, his eyes hard and piercing.
You know the man?
Well. Someone tapped his back, and he turned to find a cherub's face smiling mindlessly at him.
Why, Crocus, lad, what an inventive costume you're wearing.
Crupper?
Well guessed,
Crupper replied. The painted wooden face swung to the guard.
Oh, kind sir, I have a written message for you.
Crupper placed a scroll into the man's hand.
Compliments of a long-time secret admirer.
Crocus grinned. These guards had all the luck when it came to noble ladies. Circlebreaker accepted the scroll and slid it from the silk tie. More than once he had sensed Turban Orr's eyes on him. First in the central chamber, when it looked as if the councilman might accost him directly, and now, while others argued over who should referee the duel. Circlebreaker prayed Ralik would kill Turban Orr. He felt his own fear racing through his body, and it was with trembling hands that he read the eel's message.
The time has come for Circlebreaker to retire from active duty. The circle is mended, loyal friend. Though you have never seen the eel, you have been his most trusted hand, and you have earned your rest. Think not that the eel simply discards you now, such is not the eel's way. The sigil at the bottom of this parchment will provide you passage to the city of Davran, where loyal servants of the eel have prepared your arrival by purchasing an estate and a legitimate title on your behalf. You enter a different world soon, with its own games. Trust your new servants, friend, in this and all other concerns. Proceed this very night to the Davran Traders' Pier in Lakefront. You seek the river longboat named Enskalada. Show the sigil to any crewman aboard. All are servants of the eel. The time has come, Circle Breaker. The circle is mended. Fare you well.
Baruch threw up his hands in exasperation.
Enough of this, he bellowed. I will referee this duel and accept all responsibility. Judgment of victory is mine. Accepted by both parties?
Turban Orr nodded. Even better than Astrazian being his second. Baruch's proclaiming him victor in the duel would be a coup in its own right.
I accept.
As do I,
Ralik said, his short cloak drawn about his body. A sudden wind thrashed the treetops in the garden, sweeping down from the east. Thunder boomed from this side of the hills. A number of onlookers seemed to flinch. Turban Orr grinned, stepping into the cleared area. Leaves skirled past, clattering like tiny bones.
Before it rains, he said.
His allies in the crowd laughed at this.
Of course, Orr continued. It might prove more entertaining to draw things out. A wound here, a wound there. Shall I cut him to pieces slowly?
He feigned dismay at the chorus of eager assent.
too eager for blood, friends. Must the ladies dance on slick flagstones once darkness falls? We must consider our host.
And where was Simtal? His imagination conjured an image in answer, and he frowned.
No, indeed, he said coldly. It shall be quick.
The councilman unsheathed his sword and fastened his glove's leather straps to the ornate grip behind the bell guard. He scanned the faces of his audience, even now seeking some betrayal of expression. He had friends who were enemies, enemies who would be friends. The game would continue beyond this moment, but it could prove a telling moment. He would recall every face later and study it at his leisure. Turbinor assumed his stance. His opponent stood 10 feet away, both hands hidden beneath his cloak. He looked at ease, almost bored.
"What's this?" Orr demanded. "Where is your weapon?"
"I'm ready," Ralik replied.
Baruk placed himself equidistant between the two duelists, slightly off to one side. His face was pale, as if he had fallen ill.
"Comments from the seconds?" he asked faintly.
Rake made no reply.
Estrasian Dahl cleared his throat. "I hereby make it known that I oppose this duel as facile and trite."
He stared at Turbinor.
"I find the councilman's life irrelevant in the best of times. Should he die?"
The tall man looked over to Ralik.
"There will be no vengeance pact from the House of Dahl. You, sir, are freed of that."
Ralik bowed. Turbinor's smile tightened. "The bastard would pay for that," he vowed. He lowered himself into a crouch, ready to launch an attack as soon as the duel began. Baruk said,
"You have been heard, Estrasian Dahl."
The alchemist raised a handkerchief before him, then released it. Turbinor jumped forward and lunged in a single fluid motion. So fast he had fully extended his weapon before the handkerchief struck the paving stones. He saw his opponent's left hand dart under his blade, then twist up and outward, a short, curved knife flashing in its grip. The parry was a blur, yet Orr caught it and deftly disengaged, driving his point low and toward the man's midsection. He had no time even to notice the second knife. As Ralik turned his body sideways, the blade in his right hand guiding Turbinor's sword past him. The assassin stepped in then, his left hand moving in a high swing that buried its blade in the councilman's neck. Ralik followed this by driving his other knife into Orr's chest. The councilman staggered to one side, his sword clanging on the stones as he clutched at the gushing wound in his neck. The motion was reflex, for he was already dead from the wound in his heart. He toppled. Ralik stepped back, weapons once again hidden beneath his cloak.
"A 1,000 other deaths,"
he whispered, so low that only Baruk and Rake heard him.
"Would not have satisfied me. But I'll settle for this one."
Baruk stepped close and made to speak, but then, at a gesture from Rake, he turned to see Estrasian Dahl approaching. The councilman's heavy eyes held Ralik.
"I might suspect," he said, "given your style, that we have witnessed an assassination. Of course, not even the Guild of Assassins is brash enough to commit public murder. Therefore, I've no choice but to keep such suspicions to myself, and leave it at that. Good evening, gentlemen."
He whirled and strode away.
"I think," Rake said, his masked face swinging to the assassin, that was a rather uneven match."
A rush of people closed in around Turbinor's body. Voices shouted in dismay. Baruk studied the cool satisfaction on Ralik's face.
"It's done, Ralik. Go home."
A large, rounded woman in a bright green, gold-trimmed robe joined them. Unmasked, she smiled broadly at Baruch.
"Greetings," she said. "Interesting times, yes?"
A personal servant stood at her side, bearing a padded tray on which squatted a water pipe. Ralik stepped back with a slight bow, then left. Baruch sighed.
"Greetings, Derudan. Permit me to introduce Lord Anamanda Rake."
"Lord?"
"The witch, Derudan."
"Forgive the mask," Rake said to her. "It is best that it remain on, however."
Smoke streamed down from Derudan's nose.
"My compatriots share my growing unease, yes? We feel the approaching storm, and while Baruch continues to reassure us, still the misgivings, yes?"
"Should it prove necessary," Rake said, "I will attend to the matter personally. I do not believe, however, that our greatest threat is the one beyond the city's walls. A suspicion which, no more."
"I think," Baruch said tentatively, "that we would like to hear these suspicions of yours, Rake."
The Tester Andy hesitated, then shook his head.
"Unwise. The matter is presently too sensitive to be broached. I shall remain here for now, however."
Derudan waved dismissively at Baruch's angry growl.
"True, the Torud Cabal is unused to feeling helpless, yes? True also, dangers abound, and any might prove a feint, a diversion, yes? Cunning is the Empress. For myself, I affirm the trust between us, Lord."
She smiled at Baruch.
"We must speak, you and I, alchemist,"
she said, linking arms with him.
Rake bowed to the woman.
"A pleasure meeting you, witch."
He watched the witch and the alchemist walk away, the servant scurrying at Derudan's heel. Cropper intercepted a servant burdened with delicious-looking savouries. Taking two handfuls at random, he turned back to resume his conversation with Crocus. He stopped. The lad was nowhere in sight. The crowd milled about on the terrace, some upset, although the majority appeared simply confused. "Where was Lady Simtal?" they asked. Some, grinning, changed the question to, "Who's she with?" Already a new wave of anticipation rose among the nobles. They circled like vultures, waiting for their faltering hostess. Smiling beatifically behind the cherub mask, Cropper raised his eyes slowly to the balcony overlooking the patio, in time to see a figure appear as a dark, feminine silhouette behind the shutters. He licked sticky sugar from his fingers, smacking his lips.
"There are times," Cropper murmurs, "when celibacy born of sad deprivation becomes a boon, nay, a source of great relief. Dear Murillo, prepare for a storm."
Simtal pushed apart two slats of the shutters and looked down.
"You were right," she said. "They have indeed retired to the terrace. Odd, with that storm coming. I should get dressed."
She returned to the bed and began to collect her clothing, which lay scattered all around it.
"And what about you, Murillo?"
she asked.
"Don't you think your companion below is wondering where you are, dear lover?"
Murillo swung his legs over the bedside and pulled on his tights.
"I think not," he said.
Simtal shot him a curious look.
"Who did you come with?"
"Just a friend," he answered, buttoning his shirt. "I doubt you'd recognize the name."
At that moment, the doors locked snapped, and the door itself slammed inward. Dressed only in her underclothes, Simtal loosed a startled cry. Her eyes flashed at the tall, cloaked man standing in the doorway.
"How dare you enter my bedroom? Leave at once, or I'll call the..."
both guards patrolling this hallway have departed, lady,
Ralik Nom said, stepping into the room and closing the door behind him. The assassin glanced at Murillo.
Get dressed, he snapped.
Departed?
Simtar moved to place the bed between herself and Ralik.
Their loyalty has been purchased, the assassin said. The lesson shouldn't be lost on you.
I need only scream, and others will come.
But you haven't, Ralik grinned, because you're curious.
You don't dare harm me,
Simtar said, straightening.
Turbanor will hunt you down.
The assassin took another step forward.
I'm here only to talk, Lady Simtar, he said. You won't be harmed, no matter what you deserve.
Deserve? I've done nothing. I don't even know you.
Neither did Councilman Lim,
Ralik said quietly.
And tonight the same could be said for Turban Or. Both men paid for their ignorance, alas. Fortunate that you missed the duel, lady. It was unpleasant, but necessary.
His eyes hardened on the pale woman.
Allow me to explain. Turban Orr's offer of contract to the Assassin's Guild is now officially cancelled. Cole lives, and now his return to this house is assured. You're done with, Lady Simtar. Turban Orr is dead.
He turned and walked from the room, closing the door behind him. Murillo rose slowly. He looked into Simtar's eyes, seeing there a growing terror. Undermined by the stripping away of her links to power, her once secure defenses collapsed. He watched as she seemed physically to contract, her shoulders drawing inward, her hands clasped at her stomach, knees bending. Then he could look no longer. The Lady Simtar was gone, and he dared not study too closely the creature in her place. He unsheathed his ornamental dagger and tossed it on the bed. Without another word or gesture, he left the room, knowing with certainty that he would have been the last man to see her alive. Out in the hallway, he paused.
Maori, he said softly, I'm not cut out for this.
Planning to reach this point was one thing. Having now reached it was another. He hadn't considered how he'd feel. Justice got in the way of that. A white fire he had had no reason to look behind or push aside. Justice had seduced him, and he wondered what he had just lost. He wondered at the death he felt spreading within him. The regret following in that death's wake, so unanswerable it was, threatened to overwhelm him.
Maori, he whispered
a second time, as close to praying as he'd ever been.
I think I'm now lost. Am I lost?
Crocus edged round a marble pillar, his eyes on the rather short Bargast war maiden sitting on the fountain's rim. Damn those guards at the wood's edge, anyway. He was a thief, wasn't he? Besides, they all looked pretty distracted. He waited for his opportunity, and when it came, he darted for the shadows between the first line of trees. No shout of alarm or call to halt sounded behind him. Slipping into the darkness, Crocus turned and crouched. Yes, she still sat there, facing in his direction. He drew a deep breath, then stood straight, a pebble in one hand. Eyeing the guards, he waited. Half a minute later, he found his chance. He stepped forward and flung the pebble into the fountain. Shalistal jumped, then looked round as she wiped droplets of water from her painted face. His heart sank as her gaze passed over him, then her head whipped back. Crocus gestured desperately. This was it. This was when he'd find out where she stood as far as he was concerned. He held his breath and gestured again. With a backward glance toward the patio, Shalice rose and ran to him. As she came close, she squinted at him.
Gorlas, is that you? I've been waiting all night.
Crocus froze. Then, without thinking, he lunged forward and clasped a hand over her mouth, his other arm encircling her waist. Shalice squealed, trying to bite his palm, and struggled against him, but he dragged her into the darkness of the garden.
Now what? He wondered.
Circle Breaker leaned against the marble pillar just inside the estate's main chamber. Behind him, guests milled around Turbanor's body, arguing loudly and voicing empty threats. The air hung heavy over the garden, smelling of blood. He wiped at his eyes, trying to calm his heart.
It's over. Queen of Dreams? I'm done. I can rest now. Finally rest.
He straightened slowly, taking a deep breath, adjusted his sword belt and glanced around. Captain Stilis was nowhere in sight, and the chamber was almost empty except for a knot of servants outside the kitchen entrance. Lady Simtal was still missing, and confusion now seeped into the void of her absence. Circlebreaker looked one last time at the guests in the garden, then he made his way to the doors. As he passed a long table on which sat the remnants of pastries and puddings, he heard faint snoring. Another step forward brought him to the table's end, and into view of the small, round man seated in a plush, antique chair. The smeared cherub mask hid the man's face, but Circlebreaker could see the closed eyes, and the nasal drone that matched the rise and fall of his chest was loud and steady. The guardsman hesitated. Then, shaking his head, he moved on. Beyond the gates now within sight waited the streets of Darujistan and freedom. Now that he'd begun his first steps on that path, he would let nothing deter him.
I've done my part. Just another nameless stranger who couldn't run from the face of tyranny. Dear who'd take the man's shriveled soul. His dreams are over, ended by an assassin's whim. As for my own soul, well, you shall have to wait a while longer.
He passed through the gates, welcoming at last the smile that came unbidden to his mouth. Chapter 22.
Ravens! Great ravens! Your damning calls deride history sweeping beneath your blackened wings. Shatter the day, O flags of night, rend with shadows this innocent light. Ravens, great ravens, your drumming clouds arrive swooped sudden sheer, hissing travails from no place to the other. Shatter the day, O flags of night, rend with shadows this innocent light. Ravens, great ravens, your beaks clatter open, disgorging the sweat of straining dismay, the clack of bones promised this day. I've seen the sheen of your eyes, the laughter that rhymes the living, your passing but an illusion. We stop, we stare, we curse your cold winds, in knowing your flight's path, wheeling you round us again. Oh, forever again.
Ravens. Collett. Born 978. Raist had driven two of the black dragons from the battle. The remaining two now circled high overhead, while Silana Redwings sped down and out of sight beyond the hill. She was hurting, the Jaghut's tyrant knew, the power of her immense life force bleeding away.
And now, he said through tattered lips, she will die!
Ray's flesh had been torn away, ravaged by the virulent power of the dragons, power that burst from their jaws like breath of fire. His brittle, yellowed bones were splintered, crushed and shattered. All that kept him upright and moving was his Omto's Felak Warren. Once the finished was in his hands, he would make his body anew, filling it with the vigor of health.
and he was near his goal. One last ridge of hills, and the city's walls would be visible, its fortifications, all that stood between Raist and his greater powers. The battle had laid waste to the hills, incinerating everything in the deadly clash of warrens, and Raist had driven back the dragons. He had listened to their cries of pain. Laughing, he had flung dense clouds of earth and stones skyward to blind them. He ignited the air in the path of their flight. He filled clouds with fire. It was, he felt, good to be alive again. As he walked, he continued to devastate the land around him. A single jerk of his head had shattered a stone bridge spanning a wide, shallow river. There had been a guardhouse there, and soldiers with iron weapons. Odd creatures, taller than Imas, yet he sensed that they could be easily enslaved. These particular men, however, he destroyed lest they distract him in his battle with the dragons. He had met another man, similarly clad and riding a horse. He killed both man and beast, irritated at their intrusion. Breathed in the crackling fire of his sorcery, Raist ascended the side of the hill behind which Solana had disappeared minutes earlier. Anticipating another ambush, the Jagat tyrant gathered his power, fists clenching. Yet he reached the crest unmolested. Had she fled? He craned skyward. No, the two black dragons remained, and between them a great raven. Raist crossed the hill's summit and stopped when the valley beyond came into view. Silana waited there, her red-pebbled skin streaked with black, wet burns across her heaving chest. Wings folded, she watched him from her position at the base of the valley, where a stream wound a tortured cut through the earth, its jagged path choked with bramble. The Jagat tyrant laughed harshly. Here she would die. The far side of the valley was a low ridge, and beyond, glowing in the darkness, was the city that held his finest. Raist paused at seeing it. Even the great Jagat cities of the early times were dwarfed by comparison. And what of its strange blue and green light, fighting the darkness with such steady, unfaltering determination? There were mysteries here. He was eager to discover them.
Silana, he cried, Elaine, I give you your life. Flee now, Silana, I show mercy but once. Hear me, Elaine.
The red dragon regarded him steadily, her multifaceted eyes glowing like beacons. She did not move, nor did she reply. Raist strode toward her, surprised to find her warren gone. Was this surrender, then? He laughed a second time. As he neared, the sky above him changed, filling with a sourceless mercurial glow. The city beyond vanished, replaced by wind-whipped mudflats. The distant jagged line of mountains loomed massive, uncarved by rivers of ice, bright and savage with youth. Raist's steps slowed.
This is an elder vision, a vision before even the Jagat. Who has lured me here? He thought.
Oh my, oh my!
The tyrant's gaze snapped down to find a mortal standing before him. Raist cocked a withered brow at the man's peculiar clothing, the coat tattered and faded red with large food-stained cuffs, the baggy, shimmering pantaloons dyed an astonishing pink, and the broad black leather boots covering his small feet. The man withdrew a cloth and patted the sweat from his brow.
"Dear sir," he wheezed, "you've not aged well at all."
"There is Imas within you," Raist rasped. "Even the language you speak echoes their guttural throats. Have you come forth to grovel at my feet? Are you my first acolyte, then, eager for my rewards?"
"Alas," the man replied, "you are mistaken, sir. Krupa,
This humble, weak mortal who stands before you bows to no man, be he Jaghat or God. Such are the nuances of this new age that you are felled by indifference, made insignificant in your mighty struggles by lowly Kroppa, into whose dream you have ignobly stumbled. Kroppa stands before you so that you may gaze upon his benign countenance in the last moments before your demise. Magnanimous of Kroppa, all things considered.
Raist laughed.
I have walked in the dreams of mortals before. You believe you are the master here, but you are mistaken.
The tyrant's hand shot out, virulent power erupting from it. The sorcery engulfed Kroppa, blazing darkly, then faded, leaving not even a remnant of the man. A voice spoke to Race's left.
Rude, Kroppa proclaims. Disappointing, this precipitateness.
The Jaghat swung around, eyes narrowing.
What game is this?
The man smiled.
Why? Kroppa's game, of course.
A sound behind Race alerted him, but too late. He spun, even as a massive flint sword crunched through his left shoulder, tearing a path that snapped ribs, sliced through sternum and spine. The blow dragged the tyrant down and to one side. Raist sprawled, pieces of his body striking the ground around him. He stared up at the Talanai mass. Kroppa's shadow moved over Raist's face, and the tyrant met the mortal man's watery eyes.
He is clanless, of course, unbound and beyond binding, yet the ancient call commands him still, to his dismay. Imagine his surprise at being found out. Nonos Tulan, sword of the First Empire, is once more called upon by the blood that once warmed his limbs, his heart, his life of so very long ago.
The Talanai mass spoke.
You have strange dreams, mortal.
Kroppa possesses many surprises, even unto himself.
I sense, Onos Tulan continued, a bonecaster's hand in this summoning.
Indeed. Pran Kol of King Arvin's clan of the Kron Talanai mass, I believe he called himself.
Raist raised himself from the ground, drawing his sorcery around his body to hold its shattered parts in place.
No Talanai mass can withstand me,
he hissed.
A dubious claim, Kroppa said. Even so, he is joined in this endeavor.
The Jaghat tyrant straightened to see a tall, black-shrouded figure emerge from the stream bed. He cocked his head as the apparition approached.
You remind me of Hood. Is the Death Wanderer still alive?
He scowled.
But no, I sense nothing from you. You do not exist.
Perhaps,
the figure replied, in a deep, soft tone that hinted of regret.
If so, he continued, then neither do you. We are both of the past. Jaghat.
The figure halted 15 feet away from Raist and swung his hooded head in the dragon's direction.
Master awaits your arrival, Jaghat. But he waits in vain, and for this you should thank us. He would deliver a kind of death from which there is no escape, even by such a creature as you.
The head turned, and the darkness within the hood once again regarded the tyrant.
Here, within a mortal's dream, we bring an end to your existence.
Raist grunted,
In this age, there are none who can defeat me.
The figure laughed a low rumble.
You are a fool, Raist. In this age, even a mortal can kill you. The tide of enslavement has reversed itself. It is now we gods who are the slaves, and the mortals our masters, though they know it not.
You are a god, then?
Race's scowl deepened.
You are a child to me, if so.
I was once a god, the figure replied, worshipped as Kral, and my aspect was the obelisk. I am the maker of paths. Do you find significance in that ancient title?
Raist took a step back, raising his desiccated hands.
Impossible, he breathed. You passed into the realms of chaos. Return to the place of your birth. You are among us no more.
As I said, things have changed,
Kral said quietly.
You have a choice, Raist. Onos Tulan can destroy you. You have no understanding of what his title of sword signifies. He is without equal in this world. You can fall ignobly beneath the blade of an Imas, or you can accompany me. For in one thing we are the same, you and I. Our time has passed, and the gates of chaos await us. What choice do you make?
I make neither, Eldering One!
With a soft, hollow laugh, Raist's battered, withered body collapsed. Kral cocked his head.
He's found another body.
Cropper pulled out his handkerchief.
Oh, my, he said.
Kalam gestured sharply, and Paran ducked down. The captain's mouth was dry. There was something very wrong with this garden. He wondered if it was simply the exhaustion he felt. The garden's air itself rubbed his senses raw. He thought he could see the darkness pulse, and the smell of decay had thickened to a stench. Kalam reached for his knives. Paran tensed, unable to see anything beyond the assassin. Too many trees, not enough light. Somewhere ahead flickered gas lamps, and people were gathered on the terrace. But civilization seemed 1,000 leagues away. Here, the captain felt as if he was within a primordial presence, breathing slowly and heavily on all sides. Kalam gestured that Paran remain where he was, then slipped into the shadows to their right. Crouching low, the captain edged forward to where the assassin had been standing moments earlier. There looked to be a glade or clearing just ahead. He couldn't be certain, however, nor could he see anything amiss. Yet his feeling of wrongness now ached in his skull. He took another step. Something occupied the glade's center. Blockish, like a dressed stone or an altar, and before it stood a small woman, almost wraith-like in the darkness. Her back was to Paran. One moment she stood alone, the next Kalam rose behind her, knives glimmering in his hands. He drew back his arms. The woman moved in a blur, one elbow driving backward into the assassin's stomach. She twisted round and drove her knee into the man's crotch. A shout burst from Kalam as he reeled back a step, then fell to the ground with a heavy thump. Paran's sword was in his hand. He dashed into the clearing. The woman saw him and voiced a surprised, frightened yelp.
No! She cried. Please!
The captain stopped at that girlish voice. Kalam sat up. He groaned, then said,
Damn it, sorry. Wasn't expecting you. We figured you were dead, girl.
The woman eyed Paran warily as he approached cautiously.
I should know you, shouldn't I?
She asked Kalam. Then, as Paran came closer, she raised a frightened hand between them and stepped back.
I killed you.
With a soft moan, she fell to her knees.
Your blood was on my hands. I remember it.
A fire of rage flared in Paran. He raised his sword and moved to stand over her.
Wait, Kalam hissed. Wait, Captain. Something's not right here.
With great difficulty, the assassin climbed to his feet, then prepared to sit down on the stone block.
Don't! The girl gasped. Can't you feel it?
I can, Paran growled. He lowered his weapon. Don't touch that thing, Corporal. Kalam stepped away.
Thought it was just me, he muttered.
It's not stone at all,
the woman said, her face free of the anguish that had twisted it a moment before.
It's wood.
She rose and faced Kalam.
And it's growing.
A suspicion came to Paran. Girl, do you remember me? Do you know who I am? She frowned at him, then shook her head.
I know Kalam, she said. He's an old friend, I think.
The assassin choked on something, then coughed loudly, wagging his head. The woman pointed at the wooden block.
See, it's growing again.
Both men looked. A haze blurred the block's edges, swelling and shifting, then vanished. Yet it was clear to Paran that the thing was now bigger.
It has roots, the woman added.
Paran shook himself.
Corporal, remain here with the girl. I won't be long.
He sheathed his sword and left the glade. After winding through the undergrowth for a minute, he came to its edge and looked out on a terrace crowded with guests. A low-walled fountain rose from the paving stones to his left, encircled by marble pillars spaced about a yard apart. The captain saw that Whiskey Jack and the squad had arrayed themselves in a rough line a dozen feet from the garden's edge, facing the terrace. They looked tense. Paran found a dead branch and snapped it in half. At the sound, all six men turned. The captain pointed at Whiskey Jack and Mallet, then stepped back between the trees. The sergeant whispered something to Quick Ben. Then he collected the healer, and they came over. Paran pulled Whiskey Jack close. Kalam's found sorry, and something else besides, he said. The girl's not all there, Sergeant, and I don't think it's an act. One minute she remembers killing me, the next she doesn't. And she's got it into her head right now that Kalam's an old friend. Mallet grunted. After a brief glance back at the party, Whiskey Jack asked,
So, what's this something else?
I'm not sure, but it's ugly.
All right, the sergeant sighed. Go with the captain, Mallet. Take a look at Sorry. Any contact from the Assassin's Guild yet? He asked Paran.
No.
Then we move soon, Whiskey Jack said. We let Fiddler and Hedge loose. Bring Kalam when you come back, Mallet. We need to talk.
Ralik found his path unobstructed as he moved across the central chamber toward the front doors. Faces turned to him, and conversations fell away, rising again as he passed. A bone-deep weariness gripped the assassin, more than could be accounted for by the blood loss to a wound already healed. The malaise gripping him was emotional. He paused at seeing Cropper rising from a chair, mask dangling from one plump hand. The man's face was sheathed in sweat, and there was fear in his eyes.
You've a right to be terrified, Ralik said, approaching him. If I'd known you'd be here.
Silence, Cropper snapped.
Cropper must think.
The assassin scowled but said nothing.
He'd never before seen Crupper without his usual affable facade, and the sight of him so perturbed made Ralik profoundly uneasy.
"Be on your way, friend," Crupper said then, his voice sounding strange. "Your destiny awaits you. More, it seems this new world is well prepared for one such as Raist, no matter what flesh she wears."
Ralik's scowl deepened.
"The man sounds drunk."
He sighed, then turned away, his mind returning once again to what had been achieved this night. He continued on his way, leaving Crupper behind. What now? He wondered. So much had gone into reaching this moment. The sharp focus of his thoughts seemed dulled now by success. Never the Crusader, Ralik's obsession to right the wrong had been, in a sense, no more than the assassin assuming the role Cole himself should have taken. He had played the instrument of Cole's will, relying on a faith that the man's own will would return.
And if it didn't?
His scowl deepening, Ralik crushed that question before it could lead his thought in search of an answer. As Baruk had said, the time had come to go home. As he passed, a silver-masked woman touched his arm. Startled by the contact, he turned to look at her. Long brown hair surrounded the featureless mask, its eye-hole slits revealing nothing of what lay behind it. The woman stepped close.
"I've been curious," she said quietly, "for some time. However, I see now I should have observed you personally, Ralik Nom. Ocelot's death could have been avoided."
The assassin's gaze darkened.
"Vorkan."
Her head tilted in a fraction of a nod.
"Ocelot was a fool,"
Ralik snapped.
"If Orr's contract was sanctioned by the guild, I await punishment."
She did not reply. Ralik waited calmly.
"You're a man of few words, Ralik Nom."
His answer was silence. Vorkan laughed softly.
"You say you await punishment, as if already resigned to your own death."
Her gaze shifted from him toward the crowded terrace.
"Councilman Turban Orr possessed protective magic, yet it availed him naught. Curious."
She seemed to be considering something, then she nodded.
"Your skills are required, Ralik Nom. Accompany me."
He blinked. Then, as she strode toward the garden at the rear of the house, he followed. Crocus held one hand over Shalice's mouth as he lay atop her. With his other, he removed his thief's mask. His eyes widened in recognition.
"If you scream," Crocus warned in a harsh voice, "you'll regret it."
He had managed to drag her perhaps 10 yards into the undergrowth before she tripped him. They'd thrashed about, but he'd won the battle.
"I just want to talk to you," Crocus said. "I won't hurt you, Shalice, I swear it. Unless you try something, of course. Now, I'm going to remove my hand. Please don't scream."
He tried to read the expression in her eyes, but all he saw was fear. Ashamed, he raised his hand. She didn't scream, and a moment later Crocus found himself wishing she had.
"Damn you, thief! When my father catches you, he'll have you skinned alive. That's if Corlys doesn't find you first. You try anything with me, and he'll have you boiled, slowly."
Crocus jammed his hand over her mouth again.
"Skinned? Boiled? Who's Corlys?"
he demanded, glaring.
"Some amateur chef? So you did betray me."
She stared up at him. He lifted his hand again.
"I didn't betray you," she said. "What are you talking about?"
"That murdered houseguard.
I never did it, but..." "Of course you didn't. Father hired a seer. A woman killed that guard, a servant of the robes. The seer was terrified and didn't even say to be paid. Now get off me, thief."
He let her go and sat back on the ground.
He stared into the trees.
You didn't betray me? What about Mies, the guards at Uncle Mammoth's, the big hunt?
Shalice climbed to her feet and brushed dead leaves from her hide cloak.
What are you babbling about? I have to get back. Gorlas will be looking for me. He's the first son of House Tholius, in training to be a master duelist. If he sees you with me, there'll be real trouble.
He looked up at her blankly.
Wait!
He sprang to his feet.
Listen, Shalice. Forget this Gorlas idiot. Within the year, my uncle will introduce us formally. Mammoth is a famous writer.
Shalice rolled her eyes.
Get your feet back on the ground. A writer? Some old man with ink-stained hands who walks into walls? Has his house power, influence? House Tholius has power, influence, everything required. Besides, Gorlas loves me.
But I... He stopped, looking away. Did he? No. Did that matter, though?
What did he want from her, anyway? What do you want from me, anyway?
Shalice demanded. He studied his feet. Then he met her eyes.
Company?
He asked, diffidently.
Friendship? What am I saying? I'm a thief. I rob women like you. That's right, she snapped. So why pretend otherwise?
Her expression softened.
Crocus, I won't betray you. It will be our secret.
For the briefest of moments, he felt like a child being stroked and consoled by a kindly matron, and he found himself enjoying it.
Before you, she added, smiling, I'd never met a real thief from the streets.
His enjoyment ended in a surge of anger.
Hood's breath, no, he sneered. Real? You don't know what's real, Shalice. You've never had blood on your hands. You've never seen a man die. But that's the way it should be, isn't it? Leave the dirt to us. We're used to it. I saw a man die tonight, Shalice said quietly. I never want to again. If that's what real means, then I don't want it. It's all yours, Crocus. Goodbye.
She turned and walked away. Crocus stared at her back, her braided hair, as her words rang in his head. Suddenly exhausted, he turned to the garden. He hoped Absalar had remained where he'd left her. The last thing he wanted now was to have to track her down. He slipped into the shadows. Mallet recoiled with his first step into the glade. Perrin gripped his arm. Their eyes met. The healer shook his head.
I'll not approach any closer, sir. Whatever lives there is anathema to my Danul Warren, and it senses me with hunger.
He wiped sweat from his brow, drew a shaky breath.
Best bring the girl to me here.
Perrin released his arm and darted into the clearing. The block of wood was now the size of a table, veined in thick, twisting roots and pocked on its sides with rough, squared holes. The earth around it looked soaked in blood.
Corporal,
he whispered, chilled.
Send the girl over to Mallet.
Kalam laid a hand on her shoulder.
It's all right, lass, he said in the tone of a kindly uncle. You can go on now. We'll join you shortly.
Yes,
she smiled. I moved to where the healer stood at the glade's edge. Kalam rubbed his bristly jaw, eyes following her.
Never seen sorry smile before, he said, as Perrin arrived. And that's a shame.
They stood and watched as Mallet spoke quietly to the girl, then stepped forward and laid a hand on her forehead. Perrin cocked his head. The storm stopped, he said.
Yeah. Hope it means what we'd like it to mean.
Someone stopped it.
I share your hope, Corporal.
For the captain, however, it was a small hope. Something was building. He sighed.
It's not even the 12th bell yet. Hard to believe. Long night ahead of us,
the assassin said, making it clear that he, too, found himself sorely lacking in optimism. He grunted. Malice had voiced an amazed cry that reached them. The healer drew back his hand and waved at Paran and Kalam.
You go, the assassin said.
The captain frowned at the black man, confused. Then he went over to where the healer and Sorry waited. The girl's eyes were closed, and she seemed in a trance. Mallet was direct.
The possession's gone, he said.
Guessed as much, Paran replied, eyeing the girl.
There's more to it, though,
the healer continued.
She's got someone else inside her, sir.
Paran's brows rose.
Someone who was there all along. How it survived the rope's presence is beyond me. And now I've got a choice.
Explain. Mallet crouched, found a twig, and began to scratch aimless patterns in the dirt.
That someone's been protecting the girl's mind, acting like an alchemist's filter. In the last 2 years, Sorry's done things that would drive her insane if she'd remembered any of it. That presence is fighting those memories right now, but it needs help, because it isn't as strong as it once was. It's dying.
Paran squatted beside the man.
You're thinking of offering that help, then?
Not sure. You see, sir, I don't know its plans. Don't know what it's up to. Can't read the pattern it's trying to make. So let's say I help it, only what it wants is absolute control. Then the girl's possessed all over again.
So you think the presence was protecting Sorry from the rope, only so it could now jump in and take over?
Put it that way, Mallet said, and it doesn't make sense. What gets me, though, is why else would that presence commit itself so thoroughly? Its body, its flesh, is gone. If it lets go of the girl, it's got nowhere to go, sir. Now, maybe it's a loved one, a relative or something like that, a person who is willing to sacrifice herself absolutely. That's a possibility.
Herself? It's a woman?
It was. Damned if I know what it is now. All I get from it is sadness.
The healer met Paran's eyes.
It's the saddest thing I've ever known, sir.
Paran studied the man's face briefly, then he rose. I'm not going to give you an order on what to do, healer.
But
for what it's worth, I say do it. Give it what it needs so it can do what it wants to do. Mallet puffed out his cheeks, then tossed down the twig and straightened.
My instinct too, sir. Thanks.
Kalam spoke loudly from the glade.
Far enough! Show yourselves!
The two men spun around to see Kalam looking into the woods to their left. Paran grasped Mallet's arm and pulled him into the shadows. The healer dragged Sorry with them. Two figures entered the glade, a woman and a man. Crocus snaked closer through the vines and mulch of the forest floor. For an off-limits garden, this was a busy tangle of wood. The voices he had heard in his search for Absalar now revealed themselves as two men and one silver-masked woman. All three were looking at an odd, blurry tree stump in the center of the glade. Slowly, Crocus let out a breath. One of the men was Ralik Nom.
There is ill in this, the woman said, stepping back. A hunger.
The large, black-skinned man at her side grunted.
Wouldn't argue with you on that, Guildmaster. Whatever it is, it ain't Malazan.
The thief's eyes widened.
Malazan spice! Guildmaster! Vorkan!
Seemingly impervious to the strangeness around her, the woman now turned to Ralik.
How does it affect you, Ralik?
It doesn't, he said.
Approach it, then.
The assassin shrugged and walked up to the writhing, knotted block. Its blurred movement stopped. Vorkan relaxed.
You seem to damage its efforts, Ralik. Curious.
The man grunted.
Oteteral dust.
What?
I rubbed it into my skin.
Vorkan stared. The other man's eyes narrowed on Ralik.
I remember you, assassin.
our quarry when we first sought to make contact, the night of the ambush from above.
Ralik nodded.
Well, the Malazan continued, I'm surprised you survived.
He is a man